Again, my name is Mike Dean. I'm the Executive Director of Common Cause Minnesota. Besides campaign finance reform, we also spend a lot of time working on redistricting over the last year. And so I think the goal of this conversation is just to give you a little bit of information about what redistricting is. We're going to make some assumptions that you actually, you know a little bit about what's going on because it's been going on in your state and all in states all across the country. So just spend a little bit of time on that. But then, also to look at sort of the local level, specifically in the city of Madison. Sorry, I was going to say Minneapolis. Next to that. But I went to school here, so I'm familiar with Madison very well. But and then really sort of focus a large part of the conversation on reform. And so what can we do to address and fix these problems? Because I think that's what we really need to look forward to. Because we've seen some significant problems, both especially at the state level and in states all across the country. But first, let's go back to sort of what redistricting is. So why do we do redistricting? We do redistricting because of the concept of one person, one vote. So this came out of a Supreme Court decision. And, you know, the idea is that there should be one person, one vote. And so every time during the census, then we need to readjust the districts based upon that population changes over the past 10 years. So that's kind of the primary reason. And one of the problems with redistricting then is that, you know, as they kind of become uneven in size, you have to sort of change the districts. Wow, okay. Sorry, I'm looking at a PowerPoint here that... is not mine. It is. It's really slow. But what we've seen too many times is when redistricting is used to divide communities. And California is really the worst example of this. California, the process has been in the legislature for decades, and there you basically see the Republicans and Democrats work together to create safe districts. And out of that, a few things happen. One is you see this polarization that exists in the country right now, where they create these sort of safe districts. So you see a Democrat versus a Democrat, Republican versus a Republican. And you see them sort of moving farther and farther the edges because the race is between those two parties. Because with redistricting, you can pretty much create districts that ensure the outcome of an election. We have technology makes it so much easier these days to be able to manipulate lines. And if you've seen some of these maps, that's exactly what they're doing. In California, it has a really sort of bad example of this. But there's other reasons we care about what's happening with redistricting. There's other problems with it. The second area is incumbent protection. So the reason we live in a democracy, and in that democracy, we believe in voting, and we believe in holding our elected officials accountable. But unfortunately, you see districts being created that basically protect incumbents, and they can do this in a few ways. One is by eliminating challengers. This happened to Barack Obama, actually, in Illinois, during the last redistricting process. He challenged a long-standing congressman, got pretty close, and it was a little too close for his liking. So during the next redistricting process, they literally sort of cut his block out. And so you see this happen, and this happened in New York City. This has happened sort of all over the place. And it just doesn't allow for the type of accountability that we expect in our democracy. And then the last part is really dividing communities, and this is too often what we see. You were just talking about that example, how your city of Marshfield was split right in half, where I think you could argue that there is a community of interest there in the city of Marshfield and should really be kept together instead of divided apart. And this is too often what we see happen. And some communities have to be divided. I mean, that unfortunately is inevitable with redistricting, but the goal is to minimize that as much as possible. And unfortunately, politicians tend to not do that because they use it to basically divide these communities and then sort of weaken your voting power. And that's the overall problem here, is that redistricting through gerrymandering is being used to manipulate the outcome of elections and minimize voting power. And it's all about political power. So kind of set that up. Any sort of just general questions, I wanted to kind of stop there on sort of what redistricting is, and then we'll talk a little bit about what happened here in Madison, and then move on from there to reform.
I do, though, suppose, from what I hear, there's not much chance that this redistricting in Wisconsin will hold up in the court, people are assuming. So, but what happened to that area of interest, or the group of interest that you're supposed to be protecting?
So why don't I talk a little bit, and hopefully I can address that, because I think it's a really good point. So my name is Satya Rhodes Conway, and I'm on the Madison City Council. I represent District 12 here, which is the east and north sides of town. In my day job, I work at the university. It is a part-time job to be on the city council. And I was, as a city council member, appointed to Madison's redistricting and reapportionment committee. We had four alders and three citizens that were appointed, and we went through a pretty extensive process to make the new maps that we have adopted for the city of Madison. And what I want to talk about is, I want to give a little bit of an overview of the process, not just for the local level, but in how it fits into a bigger whole nationwide. And then I want to talk a little bit about what the law requires and kind of the principles that Madison adopted, some of the issues that we ran into, some of the issues the state has run into, and then some ideas that I have for how to do it better, at least at the local level, and then I'm going to turn it back over and we're going to talk about ways to make it better at the state level. So first let me talk about just kind of how this is supposed to go. What's supposed to happen is municipalities get the census numbers, and you start out with a map seeing where your population has changed. And technically, the counties get the first crack at it. They get to say kind of where they would like their supervisory districts to be. They know it's tentative, but they kind of lay down what their best case scenario is. And I really can't talk about what Dane County did because I didn't follow that process very carefully. I just followed the lines that they came up with. And then they're supposed to hand that over to the city or whatever the relevant municipality is. And the city draws the wards. So just so we're all clear on the language, the ward is the small unit where you actually have a polling place and that's what you vote in. And then districts are made up of wards. So just because people call them precincts or, you know, other things in other places.
A ward or precinct?
Now I think a ward is generally equivalent to a precinct. It's the smallest unit. So then the municipality draws the ward lines. They have to kind of take into account the supervisory districts, but they also have to take into account the aldermanic districts that they want to make. So, you know, already you have kind of three sets of lines to be playing with. And then, so the ward plan gets set, the city adopts the wards and the aldermanic districts, the county adopts the supervisory districts, and then the local level hands it off to the state level. And then the state is supposed to go through and do their assembly districts, and then when they get their assembly districts, they're supposed to build their Senate districts out of that. Then the state hands it to the feds. The feds do their congressional and Senate. Well, Senate's easy. And call it a day. And we do this every 10 years.
So in Wisconsin, we have nested districts, three assembly to each Senate.
Right. And is that different?
Yeah.
Wisconsin does three assembly to one Senate. Other states do different things. And I really can only speak to Wisconsin and specifically to Madison. So that's how it's supposed to work. Clearly it didn't work that way in Wisconsin this year. But I want to stick with the principle a little bit. There's some pretty clear principles that are in law that you have to respect when you're doing redistricting, at least in the state of Wisconsin, or at least it used to be this way. Your wards have to be comprised of whole census blocks, so the data comes from the census in blocks. It used to be actually literally a block, like a street block, right? Our development pattern is not that simple anymore, so it's not like little rectangles everywhere. But they do try their best to find kind of contiguous areas that are small enough and have some population in them. Although there are certainly census blocks that have very little population. But they take a map, they cut it into little pieces, they figure out, or at least they estimate who lives there. So you have to take those and put them together, like puzzle pieces, into wards. It's supposed to suit the convenience of voters. So it's supposed to make it, you know, easy to vote, basically. And it has to be, wards have to be comprised of contiguous territory, so that you can't have wards that are split up geographically. It all has to be touching. You're supposed to take into account the county plan. I already said that. And you're supposed to consider the population numbers and the racial and ethnic characteristics of that population. And this has a long history in our country. I'll take just a little tiny sidetrack here. The reason that you hear throughout this that you're supposed to take into account racial and ethnic characteristics of the population is that some states at some times, and maybe not that long ago in our history, have tried to build what you might call supermajority districts, so that you might put all, say, of the African Americans that live in a community into one district, so it's up around 80-90% African American, whereas if you had split that population, you might have two districts that were around 50% or close enough that they could impact the elections in both of those districts, instead of having one district that you can impact and another district that you can't. So there's some, you know, there's a lot of case law on this, and it's one of the things that you get told specifically to pay attention to make sure that you're not interfering with the ability of minority communities to impact who is their representative. And so in Wisconsin, there are ranges of how big wards are supposed to be. It depends on how big your community is. For the city of Madison, our wards are supposed to be between 1,000 people and 4,000 people. And our city clerk actually would prefer that they're slightly smaller than 4,000 people, because that's a lot of people, a lot of potential voters at one polling place. So we think about a lot of things in here. You have to... the wards have to be entirely within a municipality and a county. And, by the way, you can't have any of the other district lines that cross wards. So all of your lines have to line up with ward lines. Because otherwise you go to a polling place and what are you voting for? You know, if you have a ward that crosses the supervisory districts, people in some part of the ward are voting for one supervisor and another part of the ward are voting for another supervisor, and that gets super confusing. Now, we do have polling places where you have two wards voting at the same place, but at least you know by where you live what you're voting for.
Which I assume is the point of having local redistricting vote for.
That is the point of having local, yes. It's, well, and it's also to keep our city clerks sane.
Yeah,
Anyway, so you have to kind of respect those boundaries. That's important. Aldermanic districts need to contain an equal number of inhabitants. And while at the congressional district level, this is very, very strict, the equal number of inhabitants rule, it's a little less strict at the local level. And the city of Madison's plan has a 3% variance. So we figured out what an equal number of inhabitants would be for our 20 districts, and then we allowed ourselves a little range around that so that we could take some of the other principles that we thought were important into account.
The county did 5%.
The county did 5%. That's a little, I don't know about that.
I know.
But this is a judgment call, right? It, you know, how much of a variance do you allow? What are the other principles that you take into account? Your districts have to be comprised of contiguous whole wards. This is the opposite of the, you have to you have to follow the ward lines. They need to be compact. This, again, is kind of a judgment call, what constitutes compact. They need to enhance minority participation. We talked about that a little bit. And what that means might mean that you want to add minority population into a district, or it might mean that you want to take it out. It depends on
the... What do you mean by compact?
It's a judgment call. So, for example, in the city of Madison, you know the city of Madison?
I'm just trying to...
Well, so the city of Madison has two big lakes and an isthmus, right? You could make a district that's
stretched out like a snake
along the isthmus, yeah, and all the way around the lakes, and then was like really like just a few blocks wide and really long and thin. That's not very compact.
Right. No, I see what you're saying.
Yeah. So compact...
Which brings up a point of...
But you look at, compact is relative, right?
A circle.
Right. you look at a map, but you can't make circles. So you look at a map and you say, like, relative to each other, are these districts compact or not?
Is that state regulation or anything?
Yeah, this is, all of these are applicable as well. And it's not always followed as well as it could be. And they're supposed to enhance minority participation. And they're supposed to contain communities of interest. And this is real important. I'm going to talk about this a little bit more when I talk about what Madison chose to do. But communities of interest is something that is decided at the local level. And this, I think, is another reason that it's important that the local level go first, because who better to know what the communities of interest are in a particular place than the folks who live there? And what those communities of interest are going to be different depending on where you go. City of Madison also uses major arterials and other physical boundaries to define barriers when possible. And this is a City of Madison principle, it's not in law. We looked at the number of districts that are exposed to future growth. So we think about where we expect the growth of housing units to be in the city, and we think about how many districts are exposed to that. And the reason we do that is that over 10 years, populations change, and they don't change uniformly, right? So over the last 10 years, the City of Madison saw all of its growth on the edges of the city and right downtown. And it was pretty dramatic when you look at the map of the changes. So what you had was the downtown district needed to shed a lot of population to hit the target number, as did the outlying districts, and that donut in the middle needed to gain a bunch of population. So that drove how we drew the lines. If we, for example, if we had had one non-compact district all along the eastern edge of the city, most of the growth would have been there, and it would have had to shed a lot of population in order to get there. So we don't do that because we'd like to have more districts exposed to that population growth, so we have to change the lines less the next time we do this. Okay, so those are the principles. That's kind of how it works. And we'll take a pause for questions.
I'm sorry, I came in a little bit.
That's okay. What I'm going to do next is talk about the City of Madison and then the State of Wisconsin.
Okay, which doesn't apply to me specifically. However, the compactness and community of interest do.
Mm-hmm.
Because where I live in Florida is Palm Beach,
mm-hmm.
and community of interest is right on the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a interest coastal area, and there's a highway that runs up there, and they're all very expensive homes,
mm-hmm.
It's a whole other area.
But mm-hmm.
That's a community of interest.
Mm-hmm.
And it's spread in a long line up and down the coast. Okay.
So then you have the
urban people, mm-hmm. In their community homes in the cities and the towns beyond that by a few, like, quarter of a mile or so, mm-hmm. just inland.
Mm-hmm.
And then you stretch out towards the Everglades and the farms, mm-hmm. and so forth. And that could all be within, that's all in the same county.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So the community of interest would be all the farming communities together,
mm-hmm.
the urban areas together, and the coastal communities, because they're talking about hurricanes, they're talking about sand and beaches and all kinds of interests that they have. But that is not compact.
Right.
So now we go to that issue, and we just had a dog and pony show where the state legislators all came down through there. We did a little talk about all of this issues just last week. And you know, so both interests got up and spoke.
Mm-hmm.
Major conflict. Now, the state would love it to just continue to conflict, because then they could just gerrymander that whole
right.
area along the coast, which is tremendously Republican CEOs and so forth and so on that live there. And so they would like to keep that going really active.
As a district.
You know, as a district.
Yeah.
And essentially, they like to leave it the way it is, which is all twisted around. It's just as bad as California. I came from there. I lived in the Bay Area. I know what that's about. Now I live here, and it's just as bad or worse. You know, so there's this huge conflict. And I don't know where it's going to come up, but both sides are now, in our state, what's going to happen in Florida, again, it's going to be the laughing stock of the nation, because we're going to have, we already have one side with about $30 million red set for lawsuits. We've got the other side set for another. It's all coming out of our tax dollars.
Yep.
And the way they've got it written, there is absolutely no time between the time that they present it to us and the next time we have a primary. So the county voter registrator was there at this meeting. She says, there's no way I can print ballots.
Yeah.
And they won't get printed.
Yeah.
So we will not, I don't know what the end result's going to be, but we're just going to be a laughing stock of the country again.
So
as usual.
You won't be alone.
Unfortunately. What you bring up is actually a really good example of a couple of things. And one of them is just the need for reform on the state level, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But also the conflict between some of these different principles. And that's something that we actually really struggled with at the City of Madison. So let me talk a little bit about how we dealt with that.
Those conflicts are going to be universal.
Yeah. So let me talk a little bit how we dealt with that and some of the ideas that I have for how we could have done it better.
Can I just ask one question about
sure.
If the law says that the local municipalities do the redistricting first, and they didn't do this in this case.
They changed the law.
They changed the law first, just like they did with everything else.
Before he signed the redistricting bill, he signed the other law.
Yeah.
Before.
They just changed the law.
Yeah.
So it's technically legal what they did. It's not right, but it's technically legal.
It's like they've done everything else here this
mm-hmm.
year.
Exactly. So, City of Madison, relatively progressive city. You think, you know, we do a fairly good job at things. And I think we did do a fairly good job at things this time, but it definitely wasn't perfect. Let me tell you a little bit about how we approached it on the committee. We decided on a set of principles. Obviously, there's the legal things that we had to follow, and we did follow those. But we spent a lot of time talking about what constitutes a community of interest for the City of Madison. And I won't go into all of that conversation or what those community of interest really are. I'll read them for you so you have a sense of what I'm talking about. But we talked about neighborhoods in the form of neighborhood associations because they have geographies that we can map. We talked about homeowners associations and condo associations. Similarly, that's something that you can map. We talked about communities of color. We talked about income as a community of interest to take into account. We looked at elementary school attendance areas. And this was actually something that I suggested because my experience in representing my constituents is that they identify very much with the elementary school that their kids go to. And as parents talk to each other, and that there's a feeling there of a community. Now, unfortunately, the elementary school areas are not necessarily contiguous, and they're bigger than wards but smaller than districts. So we did our best to take those into account, but we couldn't entirely. We also looked at police districts, and we looked at what we call geographic identity, which is very hard to map. But if you're from Madison, you know whether you're an east sider or a west sider. You know if you live on the north side. You know if you live on the south side. And where those boundaries are exactly is very hard to tell. But it's a kind of you know it when you see it kind of a thing. So we did just a little bit of a check on that. We used all those. Now, you'll notice one of the things that we didn't use was where incumbents live. We didn't look at all. I don't even know, aside from where my own house is, and I actually know the Alder that lives closest to me. But other than that, I don't really know where people live, and I couldn't pick it out on a map if you put it in front of me, and I think none of the rest of the committee could either. We made a conscious decision not to look at that. That resulted in 2 of 20 Alders being moved out of their districts or having their districts move away from them. And that was really pretty controversial. But we stuck with the decision that the process ought to be about the communities of interest and what was best for the city, as opposed to trying to keep sitting Alders in their seats. Other communities make different decisions. Obviously.
The county,
for example, made different decisions. And obviously the state made different decisions. But we really felt like this should be as clean and as nonpartisan a process as possible. Now, that's facilitated by the fact that the Madison City Council is not a partisan body. We don't have party caucuses. We all have, well,
not all of us, some of us have party affiliations that we announce when we run, but it's there's no primary that way. There's not a primary by party, and you don't go in knowing that you're Democratic, Republican, or Green, or whatever. So it's easier to do that at the city level. I think it's also important to point out we did have citizens on the commission, which is typical of most of City of Madison committees, that we have both alders and citizens. And our citizens put in a lot of time. We went through 14 maps before we adopted one. And actually, some of those maps had sub-maps, so there's a lot more versions than that. I think we ended up doing a fairly good job. There's a lot of ways you can draw these lines. The thing that I learned in the process after trying to move some of the lines myself was that it's incredibly complex. It's very hard to build districts such that you get an entire city that meets all of the principles. And you cannot meet all the principles. So what we ended up doing was having a hierarchy of principles. And the things that were legal we had to do first, and then we had to kind of choose from there. So that's what we did. And then just before we were ready to adopt our maps, the state of Wisconsin decided that they were going to draw their assembly and Senate district maps and change the law on us and adopt them. And they did, despite hearing from multiple communities in Wisconsin, not just Madison, although I did go and testify. There were other communities that were there to testify as well. And actually, I think there are other communities that were worse impacted than the city of Madison was. Places where the lines that the state drew just make these ridiculous splits will require multiple different ballots. And one thing to keep in mind is that you not only have your municipality and your county and then your assembly districts, you also have school districts in there. So the places where, and Madison actually does have multiple school districts that cross its municipal boundaries. I wish it was contiguous, but it's not. So you start thinking about how many different levels you have to have to, in your wards to account for all of those different levels of lines, and it can get extremely complicated. The other thing that we tried to look at the city of Madison was how are we impacting our city clerk and the work that she has to do in terms of the number of wards, the number of polling places, the number of ballots that are needed for each polling place. There's just there's the kind of the functional aspect to elections that we don't often think about that's really important. So we did try to reduce the number of wards. We tried to reduce the number of polling places while not making any one polling place have too many people. And we tried to reduce the number of polling places that had multiple wards voting at it. So because any time you have multiple wards voting at a polling place, you have some confusion. Which ballot do I get? Which book do I sign now that you have to sign books? So anyway, that was what we did. And I think we did a fairly good job, but I think we could have done a better job. There was a lot of fuss over the incumbent question at the city council level. Mostly from the incumbents that were not going to have districts anymore, and I don't blame them. But we also did really hear from citizens that there is something to retaining your representative, that you voted for that person, or even if you didn't vote for that person, at least you had the opportunity to vote against them, and to have the lines changed on you such that you're now represented by somebody that you didn't have a chance to vote for or against felt very uncomfortable for a lot of people. And I understand that. It's a little inevitable in the redistricting process because the lines have to change. One thing that I think we might take into account next time, maybe not where incumbents live, but the degree of change from the old districts to the new districts, because we heard pretty strongly from a lot of people that they felt uncomfortable with this process changing things for them. The other thing that I think we would do differently, and we've talked about this a little bit already, is take alders out of the process. Have it be a citizen committee that comes up with the plan. It still has to be adopted by the city council, So you can't take the others out completely. But we felt like we felt like the alders were a little too close to it. and I won't name names out of respect for my colleagues, but I heard some things that upset me from my colleagues about the lines that they were choosing. And they had to do with what areas are harder to serve, that have more constituent service demands, and what areas are easier to serve. They had to do with what areas have a higher percentage of voters and what areas have a lower percentage of voters. So it's worth me having this area in my district and giving constituent service to them because they actually vote. But these folks don't vote, so why would I take them into my district and do all the constituent service when they're not ever going to even come and vote for me? Pretty cynical way to look at the world. So I felt like as much as I tried to keep my district and thinking about my service on the council out of the process, that's a hard thing to ask of people, and maybe it's better if you just don't put alders on the front line there. So we might think about having only citizens. I also think that one mistake we made was not checking the goals and principles that we had more broadly before we had developed maps. So I remember I said that we started out with a list of what our principles were, what our communities of interest were, and that was developed in good faith by the committee, but we didn't take that list out to the community and say, is this right? Are these the communities of interest? Did we miss anything? Before we had drawn maps. We did take it out, but only once we had maps. And then it becomes much harder to separate the two. So I think we ought to take those goals out first, run them by the committee, run them by the council, get complete buy-in, and then start drawing maps. Now, does the districting, the redistricting process timeline allow for that? I don't know. We'd have to work fast, but I think we can do it. So those are the two big things that I would say the city of Madison should do better. And I think really any municipality would benefit from that. I think some of the things that we did right that I would recommend are to really leave incumbents out of it, not know where people live. And if you had a citizen commission, it would be easier to do that. And then I think also really having a local discussion about what the communities of interest are. Let me just say a word about how what Wisconsin did affected us, and then we can open it up for questions, and we'll talk about state reform also. I talked about how the state changed the law and adopted their districts, the impact that that had on the city of Madison, less than it had on other municipalities, but still an impact. We had to adopt six additional wards that we wouldn't have had otherwise. Six of, I think all six of those were below 1,000 people, which we're not supposed to do, but you can do if you have to accommodate other lines. But the danger here is that when you get into really small wards, the secret ballot starts to be compromised. So if you only have 20 people in a ward, and you can see how the percentage fell out, you start to be able to know how people voted, and that really violates one of our principles of democracy, is the secret ballot. Now, here's an extreme example, which may come true in the city of Madison. As we go through the next 10 years, the way that we accommodate growth in the city, in the geographic boundaries of the city, we annex land into the city, those areas have to be new wards, right? So you have to create a new, when you annex land, you have to create a new ward. And those new wards have to respect the existing lines that are drawn. So I won't tell you where it is, but I'm trying to keep these people's ballot as secret as possible, but there is a place in the city of Madison that if we go through with the annexation, it's a half acre lot, it has one house on it, it will be a ward. And those people, presuming that those people vote, you will know how they voted. And everyone will know how they voted because the results are reported by ward online. And that just seems kind of severely not right to me. So that's one impact that it's had on the city of Madison. The other impact is the financial impact, in the sense that, and again, it's not huge, but it is there, and honestly, this year, every little bit counts. We will have to have more election officials at our polling places because of each of those new wards that we created will vote at the polling place that we had. They were going to vote at anyway, but now it will be two wards, so you will need more election officials. You will need to print a separate ballot. And all of this costs money, and all of this means that it will take longer to report results, just longer to get it right. And I really trust our clerk's office to get things right, but it will cost us a little more to do so. And, you know, honestly, that's not particularly fair right now for the state to do that to us.
But you won't be as long as Waukesha County.
We will not. We'll never be as long as Waukesha County.
We trust our clerk.
All right, so that's how we, that's how I feel like we're impacted by what the state did. We're living with it. We'll make the best of it. We will do the best in the city of Madison that we can to uphold the principles that we feel are important, but we really were backed into a little bit of a corner, and I know that there's other municipalities that were impacted much more severely. So let's take a short pause for questions here, and then I want to turn it back over, and we'll talk about what you can do at the state level to make sure that things like what happened in Wisconsin don't happen again. Yes, sir.
I have to disagree with you on one point, and that was it. Districts are supposed to be continuous. I know the district, and I think it's Kenosha, or we're seeing one or two, that has a district over there, district here, and up there. Honest to God. That came out of the 2000 census. Be as it may, that went into court. It was a big mess. And it's still going to be a big mess this time.
Mm-hmm.
However,
but do you think that that's a good thing or a bad thing?
I don't agree with it at all.
That the district should be contiguous?
Yeah.
So we do agree.
Hopefully. I doubt it, but hopefully it's kind of redistributed. I'm not sure. I haven't seen any new maps. Mm-hmm. But wouldn't it be more correct to start at the top and work down? And we'll let the state draw the Senate and the congressional district lines, and then the cities and the counties work around that. Would that be more plausible?
I don't think so. I think you could make an argument for it if redistricting at the state level was nonpartisan. But given that it's not...
Irregardless, it's going to be that, period. No matter how you go from the bottom up or the top down, it's going to be political. You can bet on it.
Well, Wisconsin's unique. Aren't we the only state that does it this way?
Yeah.
All the other states do it the other way.
Do it top down.
That doesn't mean it's right.
I actually think that it is better to start at the local level. It is perhaps inevitably a political process, but at least in Wisconsin, and again, I can only speak from my experience, because most municipalities, I think this is true, most municipalities have relatively nonpartisan elected bodies, at least you've taken the party politics out of it. I do honestly think, regardless of politics, that local elected officials have a better sense of communities of interest at the smallest unit, at the ward level. I think, you know, people that are elected to the assembly, I think they have a sense of communities of interest across, you know, municipalities and parts of municipalities, and I think that should be taken into account. You know, Fitchburg is different from Madison, is different from Middleton, and that's legitimate. But I also think that the smallest building blocks, the wards in the aldermanic districts, there are communities of interest within those. And I think that some of the most important principles, the minority representation, for example, are best protected if you really look at that lowest level, that smallest building block, and try and map those around communities of interest and then use those blocks to build the larger districts. Would you maybe have less conflicts and fewer small wards if you started at the top and worked down? Probably, because the wards would just be drawn towards the lines that are there because you would have to. But I'm not sure that I would trade those things.
I see it from my standpoint. I ran for the Senate seat in my district. But today, right now, today, the two representatives, well, they're going to be in 2012, it's changing. The two representatives I have right now don't ever come around in our district because it's more Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
They always go to their buddies, their mm-hmm. friends, and contact them and talk to them, and that's where all the money's at.
Yep.
So our district gets left out in the dark, if you will, but we still have the privilege of voting against them, however, because the rest of the world around us is so strong.
Which I think is an argument for having a nonpartisan map drawing at the state level,
yes.
so yep. that you draw competitive districts,
yes.
not non-competitive districts, so that your community would have, that your representatives would have to come to your community because they would need you in order to get reelected.
Well, they come to us when they do need us.
Right.
Because
we just like to make that a little more often.
Well,
yeah. But there are states who do it nonpartisan,
yeah.
correct?
Yeah.
Iowa,
yes.
for example.
Yeah, and we'll hear a little
by
bit.
Computer and
yeah.
so forth. It doesn't have to be the way it's done in Wisconsin.
But we'll hear a little bit.
That's a good transition.
That. Yeah. Ma'am, did you have a question, or should we go to the,
no, well, I just wanted to
the woman in behind? Because you two have already talked. I was just going to give people a chance.
Yeah, I was just going to ask about the expenses. Are those on city level or state level?
Oh, yes, that's at the city level.
City level.
Yeah. We pay for all the elections. It's our staff who have to staff the polling places, and we buy the election equipment. And I think the ballot cost gets shared depending on what kind of election it is.
But the redistricting is all across the board. Every
yeah.
body of government pays for that, right? Because
each body pays for its own process. Yeah, and the process actually doesn't. I mean, it cost us a lot of staff time mm-hmm. because we went through a lot of maps and had a lot of meetings. The process of redistricting doesn't cost that much. What the ongoing cost is the election cost and how many polling places you have to have and how many ballots you have to, how many different types of ballots you have to fill.
But at the state level, it did because they hired all these expensive
at
lawyers.
At the state level,
yes.
it cost a tremendous amount
yes.
of money, and that's not how I would recommend doing it. All right, so let's use that transition to talk now about things that you could do at the state level to make this process cleaner.
So obviously this process is ripe for reform. It needs to be changed. I mean, because there are some fundamental problems, I would argue, when the folks that are going to run in these districts are they themselves drawing the districts.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the problem that inherently exists at the state level and can sometimes exist at the municipal level. And so the really kind of focus is on sort of two questions. Who should draw the lines and how should they be drawn? And so let's start off with the who. And I think that's really the critical piece in where we've seen kind of reforms go in different directions. So what happens in most states is that your legislature draws the lines. And they have the power to draw the lines for both the legislature, House and Senate, or Assembly and Senate, and then the congressional lines too at the federal level. That's the way it is in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, Ohio, Michigan, I think, all states. I mean, I think it's the vast majority. I think it's something like 40 states in the powers in the legislature itself. So that's option one. That's keeping it the status quo. There's other ways that you can do it, though. One would be having judges do it. And that's actually kind of how Minnesota does it, in that if our legislature and governor fail to agree on a map, then it immediately gets kicked to the courts. And that has actually happened in Minnesota for the last 50 years.
Yeah.
The legislature and the governor have never been able to.
Year,
Yeah, and Bev would know, but it happened at least last time in Wisconsin.
Three of the last four times.
Three of the last 2000, four.
2000, I know for sure, and now it's going to the courts this time.
Yeah.
But does do the courts actually draw the maps, or
no,
is this an appeal?
They resolve the issues between the conflict.
So Voting Rights Act issues and those sorts of things.
They draw the
lines.
They draw lines.
Yeah. They start from.
So they redraw lines, kind of?
Yeah. They have people drawing them.
In Minnesota, they'll actually draw all the lines. So the legislature, the House Republicans, and the Senate Republicans produced their own map. That's what they passed, and the governor vetoed it. So there's kind of that map out there, but then the judges themselves will actually draw the map. So that's option two. Option three, having citizens do it. And this is what California does. And so in 2008, Californians supported a proposition that took the power away from the legislature and gave it to a citizens commission of 14 individuals. And then they have a process in which those 14 individuals are chosen. Anyone here, if you're a California resident, anyone can apply, and you go through basically an application process. And the objective is to have people representing sort of diverse viewpoints. So I think they actually have it. One third has to be Democrats, one third has to be Republicans, and one third is unaffiliated. Mm. So that creates an option for Greens, Tea Party,
Decline to State.
I mean, those sort of folks. And as they put together that commission, they also look at diversity, make sure geographic representation, ethnic, language, income. And so they put together this 14-member board. And over the last several months, that group has worked to assemble districts. And as of, I think, last Monday, they released their map. Go ahead.
In California, do you have to state a party? I mean, other than decline, like in Wisconsin, we don't have to vote as a Democrat or a Republican. We don't have to belong to a party in California, is there?
No.
But
this was just for the application process.
Register.
But you do register as a party or a decline.
Yeah, they have closed primaries.
Okay, they have. But also just
for the application,
you have to state.
Yes, they ask you to state.
Okay.
And so they just managed that process up, and what they've seen is a third of the districts in California, you're going to see incumbent congressional members face each other, which is a huge shift. Because what has happened in previous years, you never see incumbents face each other, very rarely, and if anything, they create safe districts, both in the legislature and the congressional races. So the first time they handed it to citizens, what happened? You're seeing a lot of members facing each other. And the reason they did that is because they focused more on not protecting the incumbents, but on creating communities, pulling communities together. As I mentioned earlier, a classic example is the city of Los Angeles. The area of Watts that was devastated sort of by the riots had been split into three different legislative districts. It's not a very big area. I mean, it's basically like the isthmus in terms of its actual size. And so what was problematic for these folks is that after the riots, all of them, they went to their legislator and said, we have a problem here, we need to address it. And they said, I don't represent you. This guy does. And they got passed around between all three representatives. Because basically what they did, and there's sort of two terms that I want you to sort of keep in mind. It's called cracking and packing. And so what they did to Watts was they cracked it. So they took the voting bloc of, I think it's African Americans, right?
Mostly
African Americans. There's also Asian populations sort of in the same area too. They basically cracked them. So they split them into three different areas to minimize their voting impact.
So no one representative had to care.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And then the other thing that they do, and this was talked about earlier, is you can pack. So instead, what they could do is just try to put all, a certain community into the same district so that they, as was described earlier, where you talked about sort of 90% of an ethnic community, you put them all in one instead where they could actually have voting power in two districts. So that's an important term that gets actually used in redistricting a lot. But this did not happen this time in California. And I think really shows the power of citizens doing the redistricting process. Also in California, they had a series of 40 public meetings across the state.
How many?
40.
It's a big state.
How, it's a big state. How many did you have Wisconsin. We had one.
Yeah. We had one.
How many did you do with this?
In Madison. The city did three public meetings where we went out into the community just to show the maps and hear from people. But we had, God, I don't know, I would say between 10 and 15 meetings of the redistricting committee, all of which are open to the public. And then we had a public, an official public hearing at the council. And then it was at another council meeting where you could come and comment as well. So we had a lot of opportunity for the public to comment. The state level, they had one hearing, started at 10 a.m. on a weekday in the state capitol, and I sat there for 6 hours until I got to testify. Mm-hmm. And there were people waiting to speak after I left.
And did they cut people off on that one?
No, they didn't cut people off, which is why it took so long. And there was a lot of question and answer, which is the other reason it took so long. But, if I hadn't been able to take off from my day job, if I had lived too far away to drive, I feel like there's a lot of communities there that weren't represented and didn't get to comment. Anyway,
so, again, option
40
three.
40 public meetings.
Okay, go ahead.
Real quick, I believe, I don't hold with it, but I think that after the fact, when everything was pretty well established, didn't the Democrats take that out to their districts?
I don't know.
I thought there were some of the Democrats
took the map out
and showed it to the people and said, this is what's being devised, right. I need your input.
Because they didn't have access to the maps until after that.
Right. After it passed the assembly, I think people took it out.
Yeah, that's when it went to the courts then, from there.
Yeah. But Bev can talk maybe a little bit about what's happening in Wisconsin when we're done.
Okay.
She knows more than both of us.
So the third option, again, is citizens, and then the fourth option is nonpartisan staff. And that's actually how they handle it in Iowa, for example, where they have nonpartisan state staff draw the maps, make some sort of computers, and have some basic criteria. So there's kind of three overall reform proposals. There's sort of the reform proposal in Florida, which what they did there is they basically created detailed criteria. So you heard a little bit about the criteria earlier, contiguity, compactness, protecting communities of interest, recognizing the Voting Rights Act, equal population, those sort of criteria. They forced the state of Florida to sort of follow those criteria more so than they have. So that's one option. Option two is the Iowa model, which is, again, having nonpartisan sort of appointees or staff draw maps, sort of based on very rigid criteria.
Iowa, is a state, independent state agency.
Okay, it's completely its own agency?
Yeah, it would be an independent agency like our Government Accountability Board.
Okay.
Which is what
and so with that, Iowa's a little bit easier to draw maps, though, than a place like Minnesota or Wisconsin, or especially Illinois. Mm-hmm. The population is very homogeneous, and so it's really, you basically draw, like Foursquare, you just sort of cut it into the different squares, and that's really all you have to do. So there's very little manipulation that really, can be done, but there's more manipulation that can happen on the political side, too. And then reform number three is then sort of the Independent Citizen Commission, and that's what we've seen in California, Arizona, and then a few of the other sort of Mountain West states have this type of independent redistricting. And I think really, that is sort of the ideal scenario, having citizens make these decisions, but again, because they don't have that inherent self-interest, they tend to be more willing to go out and listen to the community, get their input, create ways in which that can happen. But they need to sort of go through a process. And so that's what I wanted to briefly walk through then is kind of the how piece. So what should that process look like? So I think the ideal, there's kind of three overall principles, I think, that any sort of redistricting process should happen. This is coming out of the Brennan Center book that is over there. So the first is that there should be an independent commission for the very reasons I talked about earlier. Two, the process should be transparent and open so people know actually what's going on. Two, oftentimes with redistricting, these decisions are made completely behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. And like you saw in Wisconsin, what you also saw in Minnesota, what you even saw in Iowa, or in Illinois, was magically one day, a map appears. And they say, surprise, this is what's going to happen. very little public input. You know, they maybe do a dog and pony show that's really just a show, you know, for public input, and then they move on.
But it's so much more efficient, though.
Dictators are very efficient, too.
Yeah, exactly.
And then the last piece is that citizen input, and really going out and getting community input. And this is really, I think, incumbent upon the commissions itself or nonprofits to assist the commission in getting that information. And so it's going through and really asking some tough questions of the community. And I think it's two sort of general types of questions. First question is a conversation about criteria. Mm-hmm. So we talked about those criteria. Many of those criteria are either state law or federal law, so they have to exist. But there's been very little discussion about what the priority should be. Do we care more about contiguity, or do we care more about protecting communities of interest? Do we care more about compactness versus the Voting Rights Act? Do we care about competition? That was a criteria piece that we haven't mentioned so far. You know, do you want to create competitive districts? And that's actually a very controversial topic because what we've seen is that it can often be in conflict with the Voting Rights Act. So all these are in conflict, and they're always going to be in conflict. But should you have, the whole point is to have a community conversation about those items beforehand so that you can get a better feel for where folks really think what's important. So that you have that buy-in. So that's kind of piece one. Then piece two is then really to have people define their communities. And that is really critical. Whether that's in the city of do students kind of see themselves as their own community?
Right.
And how are they drawing that line? You know, where does that go through? And one of the things that we've been encouraging in Minnesota is folks actually take out a Google map and draw their community. Hmm. And then from there, define it. So this is my community because of this. It's, you know, a large population of students here. You know, we've seen these changes over the last several years. We've actually posted kind of a series of 5 questions we ask individuals to answer and supplying that testimony to the legislature or to the courts or whomever. But having that input is just so critical in the process to draw, I think, much more effective maps. So that's step one of the how. Then I think step two is sitting down and drawing those criteria, developing those criteria, and having that commission sort of agree upon that right away. That basically presents that roadmap for how they're going to proceed. Then starting to draw maps, and from there, then allowing for a public review. So you're putting a draft map out beforehand. What some groups do is they'll actually produce numerous maps and share that with the public. So here's 2 or 3 ideas that we've thrown out there, and this, what do you think about it? And give people to say, you know, I like this map better, but this needs to be changed. You know, once you actually produce a map, that's when you actually get real community input, I found.
Yep.
It, you know, it's hard for people to sort of grasp this idea, especially when you have those criteria conversations, to really understand it. But once you throw that map over, and that's what nobody does right now. I mean, it didn't happen in Wisconsin, definitely didn't happen in Illinois. And so the more we can do to encourage that, the better off we can be. And I think that was the one failing this year, is that that didn't happen. I think part of the issue, though, is technology. And so we had challenges with technology. There were a group of nonprofits that were working to actually create technology that allows people to draw their own maps. And I have found that the most helpful. I mean, you talked about that.
Yeah.
You really kind of understand the challenges that the map makers face once you actually sit down and start drawing a map. And I think we need to figure out a way to open that up, that process open, or to more people. And this is actually something that both Florida has actually done.
Yeah, with mixed results, because every citizen had to go to the webpage and get a whole map process there.
Yep.
And I tried it, and everybody, we had a dog, dog and pony show, where all our legislators marched down through Florida, and we had all these open meetings. And everybody came with their maps, but there was no map from them. So there's no one to comment on that. They said, well, thank you so much for your input.
Yeah.
That's all he kept saying, smile, thank you so much for your input. We'll go back and take all this new and we'll draw up a map.
Yeah.
That was ridiculous.
I do think that the maps are really important, though, and I think you're right that it's hard to get input before you have maps. People, I think, in a lot of ways really react to the visual, and there's an instinctive reaction to find out where your house is and how are you going to be affected. We did, in our public meetings, take I think we took two map options out to get feedback on. And we also had, in addition to just the two map options, we had a bunch of, we laid those lines down over a bunch of maps. We laid them over the current districts so you could see how things were going to change. We laid them over the ethnic populations. We laid them over the, well, basically all the criteria that I described. We had separate maps that showed how those lines mapped onto those different populations. And I think that was really helpful for people to see kind of how they were formed and react to those criteria. The other thing that I found really useful, and Bev, I think this was a link that I got off of one of your posts. There's that redistricting game where you can go, and it's a fictional geography, but you can go basically try and redistrict.
What do you feel for what?
And it, I played it a little more than I'd like to admit before we actually started drawing our maps, because it was so useful in highlighting how difficult it is to make everybody happy. And, you know, I mean, simplified, it's a computer game. It's, you know, not as complicated as reality, but it was still, it was very useful, I thought. And I really do think if you could, if everybody had access to their own geography via some kind of software that would allow you to play with those lines, there's an iterative process between playing with the lines and thinking about the criteria and then playing with the lines based on that, that I think would get us to better criteria and better maps in the end if more people could do that.
And I think that's where Florida failed, is that you did not, Florida failed to really educate the community about the process and sort of how to draw maps.
Our local representative did a good job of bringing the community together and said, okay, we're going to be doing this next week. Mm-hmm. And so here's what you're going to be looking for. We talked about all of the issues you're talking about. One thing I wanted to mention, and in what you were talking about, I like what California was doing right here, by the way. It sounds interesting. I, former California, I lived there most of my life. But like, if you have either the Democratic House or representatives, strongly Democratic or Republican in any state, and you try to redraw these lines, and you do try to, if you don't worry about where the legislators live now, that's interesting, but you can use that against everybody. I mean, you could take two Democrats and put them together in one place and fight them out. Let them fight it out, because you don't want either one of those guys back in your legislators. They've been there for a long time.
Well, and that's what they're doing right now. Yeah. I mean, what you see right now is there's kind of one of two approaches. Either what happened in California, where everybody agreed, we kind of like the way it is. We're just going to draw districts so everybody's safe. None of us have to worry too much about getting reelected, and really we can all just continue to have our fights here in the legislature rather than having to run against each other or face any credible challenge. That's one way to do it. Another way to do it is what Wisconsin did, which is basically you see one party in power, and they say, we are just going to screw the other party as much as we possibly can, and we're going to make people, incumbents have to run against each other, and we're going to draw lines to protect our incumbents or to create districts that we think we can win.
Sure.
And just, we're going to go all-out partisan map drawing. And that, I think, is what they did in Wisconsin.
If you have two people that have been strong legislators for a long time, and you put those two in the same district, you lose one of them.
Right, absolutely. What I think, both of those ways are bad, in my opinion. And I think that we should do essentially what the Democracy Campaign did here, which is draw a map which is the most competitive.
We have a copy of all that on the table there.
Which allows, I mean, they went through and they presented this at the hearing, by the way, the 6-hour-plus hearing. It creates districts that are competitive. That's one of the principles. And I actually think that, I think that would be a little harder to do at the local level, because you don't, well, at least in Madison, it would be hard to do because you don't have partisan offices, so you'd have to make a lot of assumptions that I wouldn't be willing to make. But I think at the state level, it's absolutely a principle that I would like to see adopted, is that you create competitive districts. When you have a competitive district, voters have a bigger voice. And constituents have a bigger voice because incumbents know that they are going to be vulnerable in the next election, and that if they want to get reelected, they had better serve their constituents. They had better listen to their district and serve their constituents. And believe me, the only competitive race that I've ever had, even at the local nonpartisan level, was my first race. At a four-way primary, we have nonpartisan primaries in Madison. At a four-way primary, top two people go on to the general. I was one of those two, and I won.
Was it an open seat?
It was an open seat.
Yeah, see, that's the difference.
I have run twice. I'm in my third term, and I have not been opposed. And I'd like to think it's because I'm doing a good job, and I think I'm doing a pretty good job. But I actually don't think that's most of it. I think most of it is that it's very hard to run against an incumbent. And it takes a fair amount of money. I mean, it's not that much money in the city of Madison, but it takes money to run against an incumbent. It takes money to run, period. And it's just very hard. I don't really want to have a competitive campaign, but I would feel better about our democracy if I had competitive campaigns. And I feel like it would make me work a little harder. It would make me go it more into the areas of the district that I feel like are less certain in their support of me. And I think I would be a better legislator for it. So I'm trying to keep all that in mind and do it anyway and, you know, be a good person. But honestly, politicians are motivated by votes. And if they know that those votes are competitive and that they will be challenged, they will give better service to their constituents, I think, almost without exception.
And when it comes to competition at the state level, you're not going to have, every district cannot be competitive. And so I just want to make sure everyone understands that. Madison is not going to have a competitive, probably
competitive in different ways.
Or, I mean, you would have to gerrymander it so much. But the whole idea of the competition is maximizing the number of seats.
Right.
So again, in California, its congressional delegation of the 54 seats it had, it only had three competitive congressional seats because of how they sort of crafted it. And so how do we make sure that it's anywhere from a third to a little bit more than that, you create what they call accountability districts. And so it assures that there's accountability during these elections, that the outcome isn't already predetermined. So that can have an impact then on who controls then the legislature.